It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Militia clashes in Tripoli suburbs. Young Pakistani activist calls for freedom for the abducted Nigerian schoolgirls. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The Libyan government has called for an end to militia clashes near the capital Tripoli that's left at least 6 dead and 25 wounded Sunday. The Prime Minister's spokesman, Ahmed Al-Amin, said at a news conference the regional armed groups fighting to control the capital's international airport are acting without any orders or legitimate cover from the government. The violence broke out Sunday when armed Islamists attacked Zintan militia, who've controlled the airport since the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. The opposing groups are seen as the arm wings of two political factions, one liberal, the other Islamist, struggling for the upper hand in the Libyan parliament. Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau has issued another video, this time claiming responsibility for two blasts last month, one at an Abuja shopping mall in which at least 22 died, another at a fuel depot in the commercial capital Lagos. He also claimed his group was behind car bombings in the central city of Jos in May and a June attack on a college in Kano. Boko Haram earlier claimed responsibility for the abduction of more than 200 schoolgirls from a school in Chibok in Borno State. That kidnapping has drawn international condemnation. Pakistani teenage activist Malala Yousafzai is in Nigeria campaigning on behalf of the schoolgirls.
You are really brave parents who have taken this step to speak up for their daughters and to speak up for their right of education. And I'm hopeful that the government would listen to your voice and they would listen to what you are saying. You just want your daughters back. You want your girls back. So I would love to hear from you as well, so I can take your message and tell it to the president, whom you consider your father, and as well as I'll say it in my speech tomorrow.
She met with relatives of the girls and those involved in the so-called Bring Back Our Girls campaign. She says she hopes her presence will place more pressure on the government to bring the girls home. In 2012, Ms. Yousafzai was shot and nearly killed by the Pakistani Taliban because of her efforts to promote education for women and girls. The attack amplified her voice. The Democratic Republic of Congo has dropped a plan to impose visa fees on cross-border traders from Rwanda. Nick Long reports this development follows clashes last month in which five Congolese soldiers were killed by Rwandan troops.
Tens of thousands of Rwandans regularly cross the border between the towns of Gisenyi and Goma, most of them transporting produce. A number of these traders are disabled and would have difficulty finding work other than peddling carts across the frontier. Jean-Baptiste Nyamulinda is one of these disabled traders. Speaking to VOA before the visa plan had been dropped, he said he had been told he would have to pay $50 for a three-month visa. He had not heard that disabled people would be exempt and was hoping God would help them. Several other traders told VOA they would not be able to afford visas, which they had been told would be $50 for 3 months for informal traders, $30 a year for students, and $250 a year for salaried people living and working in Goma. However, the threat of trade visas now appears to have been lifted after some outside intervention. A regional body, the Economic Community of Great Lakes Countries, wrote to DRC authorities asking for clarification and pointing out that the visa plan was in breach of a regional agreement on free movement of goods and people. Officials in Goma said that this fee does not apply to cross-border traders who visit Congo on a daily basis. Nick Long for VOA News, Gisenyi.
The French press agency says Burundi's interior minister has denied any government involvement in an alleged attempt by a policeman to assassinate a prominent opposition leader. An armed plainclothes officer was arrested Saturday after acting suspiciously near a meeting in Bujumbura between Charles Indidija of the Aprona party and his aides. In Egypt, at least 8 people, including a soldier, were killed in the Sinai in 2 successive explosions near the border with Israel. A security official says the apparent target late Sunday was a military outpost in El Arish, that 24 others were wounded. Meanwhile, the French press agency reports more than 100 more supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi were sentenced Sunday to 3 years in prison for acts of violence in the Nile Delta city of Damietta. A blast in western Algeria has killed 7 soldiers. They died in the roadside bombing Saturday near the town of Sidi Chaib, about 440 kilometers west of Algiers. The defense ministry said the soldiers were supporting local auxiliary forces when they were hit by a homemade bomb. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, July 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian police say they have uncovered a plan to bomb Abuja's transportation sector.
I want to reassure citizens that there's no need for them to begin to panic. The security forces are working around the clock to ensure that they effectively neutralize and deal with this issue.
Frank Umba is Nigeria's national police spokesman. South Sudan's warring parties are again trading accusations of violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement. An offshoot of Zimbabwe's opposition MDC says President Robert Mugabe should resign. And a Ugandan opposition figure says the government is to blame for last week's Wenzori violence.
Ethnicization of politics, pitting communities against others, and the divide and rule policy eventually can lead to a total disaster for the country through identity conflict.
Dr. Kizza Besigye is the former president of Uganda's Opposition Forum for Democratic Change. And a new vaccine and other strategies may soon control dengue fever. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian police say their intelligence reports show credible plans by terrorists to attack the transportation sector in the capital, Abuja. National Police spokesman Frank Umba says there's been stepped-up security at major parks around the capital area. He tells reporter Peter Clotty police have reassured the public not to panic because security agencies are working hard to prevent the terrorists from carrying out their planned attacks.
This specific threat is a very credible threat, and the threat is not targeted at the entire federal capital territory. Is a specific threat targeted at the transport sector. But the good news is the fact that this plot was uncovered and uncovered quite timely. I want to reassure citizens that there's no need for them to begin to panic. The security forces are working around the clock to ensure that they effectively neutralize and deal with this issue. We're leaving no stone unturned in this regard, and we're just asking citizens to remain perpetually alert and vigilant and report any suspicious movement, suspicious object, and suspicious activities within their area to the security forces.
How has the public reacted in terms of cooperating with the police in some of these investigations that you are conducting in order to thwart these planned attacks?
The cooperation has been massive. Nigerians have risen in unison, in total solidarity with the security forces, with the federal government, and with the relevant agencies that are saddled with the responsibility of providing internal security. We've been getting massive cooperation from citizens in terms of information and all forms of cooperation. And we are positive that with this new wave of unity, with this new wave of togetherness, we will come out stronger and better as a people and as a nation, and we will overcome the threat of terrorism, not just within our borders, but also within the entire continent.
There are concerns that the transport industry specifically is a soft target to some of these militants, and that although police bolstered security in some of these areas, more need to be done. What do you say to such concerns?
This threat that we uncovered even before it was actualized will not destroy the transport system in Nigeria. We will work together with our people. We will work together with our citizens. We will work together with government at all levels. So I assure that we neutralize this threat and that life and businesses in Nigeria, we continue. We are building a country that is developing a strong resilience. We are building a country that is developing a strong response mechanism to the issues of threat associated with terrorism and other forms of criminal activities. And I can assure you, we will overcome.
Frank Umba is Nigeria's national police spokesman. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The former leader of Uganda's main opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change, says President Yoweri Museveni's government is to blame for the Wenzori violence that left about 90 civilians and security personnel dead. Chisa Besigye accused the government of fueling ethnic tension by partitioning Uganda into tribal enclaves. But government spokesman Ofwono Opondo reportedly said Besigye is a prophet of doom. Opondo says the violence took place because the tribes failed to manage their internal problems. Besigye tells me that if the violence were tribal, then how come only the police and Ugandan military were targeted?
That the tensions there have been built by actions of government, and in fact by actions of Mr. Museveni specifically, who not only in that region but in the whole country has been causing divisions amongst the communities in an attempt to manipulate them for electoral gains. A cultural institution was recognized after years of by the communities there for recognition. Mr. Museveni then made a U-turn and said he was recognizing the institution and installed the king of what is called the Wenzururu, which is the communities of the Rwenzori Mountains. He had hoped that that would then swing the support in the region to his favor. There was a by-election last year, which he then threw his weight there with all that expected benefit in mind. And to his shock, his party was resoundingly defeated. And beyond that, he has also tried to create administrative institutions based on the ethnic groups, subdividing the area on ethnic lines. And so there has been tension developed by through the actions of government. And so it's not surprising that those tensions eventually ended in violence. In fact, one of the other things why some of the communities would be looking for guns to arm themselves is because he has actually armed some of the communities against others.
Dr. Besigye, the government spokesman of Ofwono Opondo, reacting to your comment, described you as a prophet of doom, saying that the tribes are to be blamed for the violence.
Well, but he should not just call me names. He should just respond to what I am saying, whether those actions I am attributing to government were actually committed by the government. And there is no doubt at all that that is the case.
Basically, what he said is that he thinks that the tribes have failed to manage their internal problems. But he said the government will take care of that.
Yeah, but it's not the tribes that create administrative units. It is Mr. Museveni who does, and therefore divides the societies administratively by law and putting new leaders in the new administrative entities he creates. The tribes have no say over that. It's not the tribes that have been dividing the land between the pastoralists and the cultivators. The tribes have no power over the division of the allocation of the land.
You have said, Dr. Besigye, that you think that this ethnic friction is a political disaster, not just for Museveni, but for the whole country. What do you mean?
Of course, ethnicization of politics, pitting communities against others, and the divide-and-rule policy eventually can lead to a total disaster for the country through identity conflicts.
Dr. Chisa Besigye is the former president of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change of Uganda. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. In Zimbabwe, an offshoot of the opposition movement for democratic change, calling itself the MDC Renewal Team, says President Robert Mugabe should resign for presiding over an economy that is sliding into recession. Thomas Chiripasi of VOA Zimbabwe Service has details from Harare.
MDC Renewal Team spokesperson Jacob Mafume told Studio 7 that President Mugabe has failed to lead the country and urged him to resign from his post to pave way for fresh polls. This comes at a time when ZANU-PF has admitted that it is ready to engage the country's opposition parties with a view to finding solutions to problems affecting the country following former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's calls for national dialogue. ZANU-PF has also set a precondition that Mr. Tsvangirai should recognize the outcome of last year's national elections, which the MDCT claims were rigged by President Mugabe and his party. Mafume tells Studio 7 that any form of negotiations with ZANU-PF were retrogressive, adding the best way forward is for Mr. Mugabe to throw in the towel.
When someone fails to do their job, they must simply resign and leave. Now, ZANU-PF has got a number of options. It's either they can quickly get rid of their chief executive, who is President Robert Mugabe, who is clearly failing to deliver on a simple mandate to make people live well. Or alternatively, if that cabinet and ZANU-PF cannot take that decision, then President Mugabe should fire the cabinet and bring in people who can competently deliver in terms of the economy.
Mafume said polls to be held thereafter should only be held after key democratic reforms have been implemented to ensure an undisputed outcome. Mr. Tsvangirai on Wednesday claimed that Mr. Mugabe's illegitimacy was the major cause of the current economic meltdown.
Without reforms and without realignment of the electoral management and also the electoral laws to the Constitution, there is no point in participating.
Contacted for comment on the calls for Mr. Mugabe to step down, ZANU-PF spokesperson Rugare Gumbo said he was in a meeting while several calls to the ruling party's secretary for administration, Didmus Mutasa, went unanswered. But ZANU-PF activist Maurice Ngwenya told Studio 7 by phone that the MDC renewal team is seeking attention and is now using national issues to divert focus on the internal squabbles in the MDCT. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Both sides in South Sudan's civil war continue to blame each other for violating the cessation of hostilities agreement. The South Sudan military said rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar attacked government positions in Unity and Upper Nile states on Friday. But a rebel spokesman says government forces first attacked rebel positions. Philip Aliu of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
SPLA spokesperson Colonel Philip Aguirre says government forces came under attack in Wankai and Gwet in Unity state. He says the government army defended their positions.
The attacks in Unity State are repulsed, and the SPLA is still committing to the ceasefire. We are also monitoring a move by forces of Riek Machar in a plan to attack Ayud, and they are coming closer to Ayud. And the forces of the SPLA, mandated by the Constitution, remain the National Army that is protecting the civilians, protecting the territorial integrity of the Republic of South Sudan.
Opposition military spokesperson Lurwai Kwang denies the accusation and says it was government forces that attacked the rebel bases in Unity and Upper Nile states.
The day before yesterday and yesterday, the government troops moved out of Nasa town, went to two villages. One village is called Weitut, another village is called Dording. They burnt down some parts of those two villages, and they were repulsed. They went back to Nasa town. Today in the morning, some government troops, actually, two locations in Unity State. Went to Good County, east of Antil Town. They left their vehicles on the main road, went on foot to the nearby villages, and started attacking our positions. They did the same in a place called Tarquir, that's in Mayom County. And the government is entirely responsible for those attacks. They launched and provoked attacks on our positions.
Both sides continue to blame each other for attacks in violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement signed 2 months ago. Again, Colonel Aguirre.
We are monitoring movement of armed militia or forces that are crossing from the Republic of Sudan, joining forces of Riek Machar in Unity State and Upper Nile, but SPLA will continue to monitoring them. We will never move out of our bases, but will teach them lessons while they continue to attack SPLA.
The original ceasefire signed in January by two parties was quickly broken. The one signed again in May between President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar has largely failed to end the fighting in Upper Nile, Unity, and Jonglei states. For BOA News, I am Philip Aleu in Juba.
Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, after hosting a successful FIFA World Cup, is also working on another big event. Her country will host the 6th annual BRICS Summit, which begins today, Monday. BRICS, the acronym for a group of 5 emerging national economies with significant influence on regional and global affairs, includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Mariama Diallo looks into the issues that will be discussed during the two-day meeting.
The group of 5 will convene in the northeastern Brazilian city of Fortaleza. Internal cooperation and sustainable development are likely to top the agenda of the two-day summit, says Harold Trincunas of the Brookings Institution.
We should expect to see the announcement of a major new multilateral development bank in which the 5 member states will each contribute a certain amount of capital, up to $100 billion total over a number of years. There's also some discussion of setting up a contingent reserve authority, which sort of would be an alternative to the IMF.
Discussions to create a lending institution similar to the World Bank started in New Delhi 2 years ago, but the Indian government says nothing is set in stone yet. Sujata Mehta is with the country's foreign ministry.
We are still at the stage when we are negotiating it, so I wouldn't want to speculate on what roadmap there will be for utilizing it.
Ross Anthony of the Center for Chinese Studies at South Africa's Stellenbosch University says establishing the bank would help the BRICS countries achieve tangible economic benefits.
Without a bank, without something material that backs up the rhetoric of these 5 economies grouping together, BRICS will remain more of a talking club than something more substantial.
However, setting up a bank of that size and reach is not likely to yield immediate results.
Most of the other successful multilateral development banks that we know of, such as the World Bank, really took many years, decades even, to really become fully operational and consolidated and establish a global reputation as lenders.
There is also concern about economic growth slowing in most of the BRICS countries. But Trincunas says most of the member nations have large foreign currency reserves and are not expected to enter a major crisis anytime soon. Meanwhile, some critics say that as important as economic development issues are, international affairs topics should also be discussed. Russia's recent annexation of Crimea is one example. While the United States and its European allies heavily criticized Russia, reaction from the BRICS countries was almost non-existent. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
There is new hope for those who suffer from dengue, a virus characterized by hammering headaches, high fevers, and pain. VOA's Carol Pearson reports about a possible new vaccine reported in the Lancet Medical Journal and other ways to contain this sometimes deadly virus.
The mosquito-borne disease is called brick bone fever because dengue causes a high fever and such severe pain that people who have it feel that their bones are breaking. It can take months to recover, may require hospitalization, and it kills 22,000 people each year, mostly children, according to the World Health Organization. The WHO says the virus is now 30 times more prevalent than it was 50 years ago. It's common in many regions of Asia, the Pacific, the Americas, and Africa. There are no particular drugs to fight dengue, but now there is hope. A promising vaccine could be a game changer after a 2-year trial in 5 Asian countries. Dr. Maria Rosario Capeding is one of the researchers in the Philippines. She says during the trial, the vaccine cut the number of dengue cases in half and significantly reduced the number of severe cases that cause hemorrhaging.
The vaccine efficacy against dengue hemorrhagic fever, according to the WHO criteria, after 3 vaccine doses was 88.5%.
There may soon be other ways to prevent or contain the virus. At the Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Institute, Professor George Demopoulos has discovered a way to block the dengue virus in lab mosquitoes. The next step, he says, is to do the same in wild mosquitoes.
Dengue, as malaria, are diseases that will only be controlled through the use of multiple approaches. It's like a war. You cannot win a war with only one weapon. You need multiple types of weapons and strategies to win a war, and the same applies for these diseases.
The World Health Organization estimates that 40% of the world's population is at risk for developing dengue. By this time next year, there may be a way to fight it. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin at the FIFA World Cup in Brazil. Germany are FIFA World Cup champions. The Germans required extra time to pip Argentina by a solitary goal scored by Mario Götze in the 112th minute to emerge victorious in Rio de Janeiro on Sunday. Talking to my colleague James Batty, former president of Uganda's main political opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, Kizza Besigye, had this to say about the match.
No, I think we've just witnessed a very deservingly great finale to the Brazil 2014. It was a very entertaining final, rather too physical, and even towards the end almost turning bloody. But it was a very entertaining match. The Germans definitely had a superior team and deserved every bit of the win they got. Though certainly the Argentinians, whom I was backing, put up a very credible and, encouraging fight. But I think the best team won.
That was Kizza Besigye, former president of Uganda's main political opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, speaking in Kampala, Uganda. Meanwhile, earlier on Saturday, Netherlands salvaged some national pride with a resounding 3-0 triumph over Brazil to clinch the bronze medal in the capital, Brasilia. Turning to athletics, Ethiopian All-Africa Games champion Hiwot Aeleu clocked 9 minutes and 10.64 seconds to triumph in women's 3,000-meter steeplechase at the IWF Diamond League in Glasgow, Scotland on Saturday. Not only did she set a new meet record, Aeleu's time is the world's quickest in the event this year. Kenyan Olympic champion David Lekuta Rudisha also clocked a world-leading time of 1 minute and 43.34 seconds in 800 meters. He shares the world-leading time with fellow Kenyan Asbel Kiprop. Other triumphant Africans were Botswana's Isaac Makwala, Kenyan Silas Kiplagat, and Ethiopian Hagos Gebrehiwet in men's 400 meters, 1500 meters, and 5000 meters, respectively. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a lovely Monday. Our listener mail for this Monday morning, July 14th.
I wish to thank the federal government of Nigeria and lecturers of the Polytechnic and College of Education in Nigeria for calling off this strike. Thank God all the whole problems are over. We pray and we call on the students to go back to schools and resume lectures. Comrade Mazi Patrick Okorobra for all blood premises at an Arasuku in Abia State, Nigeria.
And we thank you, listener, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's it for this Monday, July 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butte saying have a lovely and productive week.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.